pray. Amen. Please be seated.
All right, well, good morning. It's nice to be here this morning. You may notice that I'm up here with socks on, and that's because this is a stage and this is trying to be reverent towards just a holy ground. No, I wore my boots to church this morning, and I didn't want to wear boots up here, so that's why I have socks on today. But I want to share a little bit about myself this morning. Some of you are new here, and my name's Randall. I'm an intern pastor here at Country Hills. And I want to kind of begin this morning with just sharing a little bit about myself and where I come from. Just want to make sure the PowerPoint's up and running. Oh, got to try it again. Just unplug that. Oh, there we go. Okay, good. We're rolling. So yeah, I grew up in this tiny little town, village really, called Hixson. You can keep the lights on for now, Jim. There'll be a video in just a few more minutes. But, when I say Hixson, some people are like, oh yeah, I've heard of that. I've driven through there once. It was pretty quick. I blinked and it was gone. Kind of like that. And it's true. I mean, I think there was only about 300 people who really live there and call it home. But for me, I haven't lived there for a few years. My parents still live there. But when I go back, it's still home. It still feels, the whole village, the community still feels like home. And I still remember we moved there when I was about 7 years old. And I remember the very first friend I made there. He would be biking up and down the street all the time. And he had this like bright orange neon bike. It was new and it had like gears and it was awesome. At least I thought, because I had this old like, you know, the bikes without gears and you had to like push back on the pedal to stop. I had one of those like lame bikes and he just had this cool bike. And one day, he just stopped and said, hello. And I don't know what happened after that, but eventually we became the best of friends. We were always hanging out. And I loved going over to his house because there we could have pop a lot. I loved pop. It's so good. But we would also get to play video games. He had, like, the regular Nintendo. And then once the Super Nintendo came out, he got Super Nintendo, like, he just had it all, so I just loved hanging out at his house. And I'm sure my mom, I'm sure she was quite happy for me to have a friend so quickly, and such a good friend so quickly when we moved there. But then, as time went on, some things started to change, because we hung out a lot. And so my friend would be calling quite regularly, and my mom would often pick up the phone, like moms do, and she would start handing me the phone and being like, it's your friend again, rolling your eyes. You know, only the only way a mom can do, you know, just that big eye roll. But then she would whisper. But it wasn't like a real whisper. It was kind of like loud enough that the person on the other end of the phone might actually be able to hear it too. And she would say like, he's calling again. You can't go over there. We have dinner soon. Or you got to do your homework. But I don't think she really cared. I think she wanted him to know the message that, like, you can't just call all the time. You got to wait till the dinner hour's done. So now, if that was all it was, and that was all that annoyed my mom, then, you know, she's a little too high-strung, and I would say, in that situation. But my friend was doing more than just calling all the time. He would start coming over a lot. And he was breaking two very common social graces that my mom that was a faux pas for her. It was just like a no-no. So he would come over without calling. He would just kind of just all of a sudden be there. But then he would also do this. He would just walk in. No knock, no ringing on the doorbell, just walk in. Didn't matter if we were having supper, didn't matter, you know, the time of day. He would just walk right in. And so my mom was still a very nice mom, and she would still like be gracious to him and still be nice and offer him something to drink if he was coming. But she started to impress upon me that you got to say something. You got to do something. I miss those early childhood days. I miss that relationship that you could build with a friend where they feel so comfortable, they feel like you're so close, that they would literally walk right into your house. I don't know if you guys grew up in a neighborhood like that or had an experience like that. And maybe some of you still do. I don't know, perhaps. But for myself, I don't have that experience anymore. Nicole and I, we've lived in the same neighborhood for over 2 years, and we're acquaintance with some of our neighbors, but we're not good friends. They're not close people that we can rely upon, that we can just pop over anytime we want. But I don't think I really speak for myself when I say that. I feel like there's probably quite a few of you out there that don't actually know your neighbors that closely, that you're acquaintance with them and you might say hi to them every now and again, but you know that type of close, neat, tight-knit relationship isn't there. But I think deep down we all want a genuine community experience like that, don't we? I think deep down we all want to be able to have people who are just a phone call away, who we can literally walk up to in an emergency and they will be there to help us drop what they're doing. The video we are about to watch looks at some of the issues that have resulted in the breakdown of communities and neighborhoods in our lives. So, Jim, if you want to just get the lights for me, please, we'll cue up the video here.
Community in America is broken. A recent study indicates that for the average American, there's only two people that they can confide in for any meaningful conversation. And for the rest of us, we don't have anyone at all. Growing up in Michigan, cars were a big deal. As a matter of fact, as I was growing up, we used to do assemblies at school that just went over the history of the automobile. In the 1950s and 60s, Detroit was the place to be. It was the Motor City in the age of the automobile. Cars were such a big deal to the city that they made an intentional choice to take out the trolley system so that for the average Joe, his only option was to own a car to get to work. Matter of fact, most families probably needed two cars, one for mom to take kids to school and one for dad to get into the city to work. They brought in the freeway system, and these freeways didn't go around these communities, they just cut right through them. And at the time, no one had any idea what the consequences of doing that would be. 60 years later, we have a man named Robert Putnam who did a study on the social fabric of America. And what he found was that for every 10 minutes of commute, we're 10% less likely to have meaningful relationships. The average commute for America today is 30 minutes each way. I mean, most of us, we don't even know our neighbors. I know it's really hard for us to believe that we're that disconnected, that we're that isolated from one another. Because when we look around the world, we've got more options for connectivity than we've ever had before. The average Facebook user has 314 friends and is connected to 80 community pages. But if that community was real, if it was authentic, if it was life-changing, would we have issues like depression and loneliness as such a big part of our life? They say by the year 2020, the second most common health issue around the world will be depression. We weren't built for isolation. We weren't meant to live lives disconnected from one another. In fact, we were created in the image of a God who exists in community. We were created for community.
If you could get the lights again, Jim. It's an interesting video, isn't it? Kind of alarming when you look at some of those different stats and stuff. There was something else that I had stumbled upon a few years ago. I can't remember if it was a book or in a classroom or something, but I wanted to look at like the houses that we live in and how they're built and kind of designed. Take a look at that house there. That's a house that was built in the late 1800s. You've all seen a house like it. It's a pretty iconic image of a house of that time period, isn't it? But you'll notice something interesting, that there's a front porch on there. I don't know, I recently watched the movie, not recently, but I watched the movie in the past year, the movie Up. It's a great little Pixar movie that you have this, you know, the old man who's getting ready in the morning and he looks like he's going to go out for his day, and what does he do? He just opens the door and turns right and goes and sits down on his porch. Today, I don't see many houses with porches on them. You have the front entryway, but that's usually about it. Today, most houses have a deck. We build that to host people and have people over. But notice the difference between the two. There, you're sitting on the front porch. You're there for the public to see. You're there for your neighbors. When they walk by, you can say hi to them. You can say, hey, come on up, have a glass of water. Here, it's private. If you're sitting in your backyard, nobody's walking by to say hi to. Maybe your neighbors if you don't have a fence. But you're not saying hi to the person walking by. There's a difference between being the front porch was open. It was an open stance to your community. You were public. You were there because you knew your neighbors. It was okay to sit on the front porch. You wanted to say hi to your neighbors. Now we have decks. We sit in the backyard to be private. We can have people over, but it's on our terms. It's not necessarily just the randomness that you find when you sit on the front porch. I'm not blaming anyone for having a deck. It's entirely normal. But it's an interesting trend that's occurred in our culture, isn't it? We know that community's broken down. But the issues do run far deeper than just how our houses are designed or how far we commute. One of the main issues affecting community is the importance that our culture emphasizes on our own individuality. See, no longer do we approach communities with the mentality of, what can I do for my community? We more approach a community now with, what can my community do for me? Recently, I read the book called When the Church Was a Family by Joseph Hellerman. Very interesting read if you ever have the chance to stumble upon it and read it. And the book's about the breakdown of community in our churches, of family. And N.E.D. makes a very pointed observation about one of the primary causes for community degradation. Here's this quote. We in America have been socialized to believe that our dreams, goals, and personal fulfillment ought to take precedence over the well-being of any group, our church or our family, for example, to which we belong. Yeah, well, we are not Americans. I think our culture is similar enough in this capacity that we don't really question this statement. I think that's entirely true. That's an accurate observation. We believe that we are responsible for ourselves, and you might say it does not really matter where you live or what church you go to. Like, we can build community wherever, right? Like, it's not, like, you can't, in theory. Not too long ago, I watched the movie Invictus, starring Matt Damon and Morgan Freeman. It's a sports movie set in 1995, chronicling the rise of a predominantly white rugby team. Matt Damon was the captain of that team, who was endorsed by their black president at the time, which was Nelson Mandela. Obviously, a hero of our times and our culture. And the movie explores some of Mandela's history, and it highlights a particular poem that he had memorized when he was in prison. And he was in prison for, I think it was 19 years. And at the very end, the last stanza, and this is what caught my attention when I was watching the movie. Matters not how straight the gate, how charged the punishments the scroll, or how charged with punishments the scroll. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. When you watch the movie, it's so moving and it's so cool. You hear Morgan Freeman's voice narrating that, and you're like, yeah, that's awesome. But then part of me stepped back, and I was like, what does that really mean? I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. It's almost the spirit of the American dream, I think. I think the poem reinforces that very central belief in our culture that we ultimately decide our own fate. The reason it's so appealing, that idea, that belief, is because there's some truth to that. But biblically, it's not the entire picture. It's not the entire pieces. It's not all the pieces of the puzzle. Because ultimately, when you look at Scripture, we are not the masters of our own fate. I'm not talking about a predestination kind of thing. But because God gave us the opportunity and the freedom to try life all on our own. It started with Adam and Eve, and it's continued on to this very day. But humanity, you and me, screwed up. There's sin in this world. There's breakdown of the community, obviously. We're incapable of saving ourselves. And so this message that runs so deep that we can build the life as we want it comes with a compromise. Since we can do it on our own, maybe our communities can serve to achieve our goals, our personal fulfillment. We can use them for our needs. The breakdown of community, it's also affected the church, which is why here at Country Hills, we've tried to make a commitment to building community. It's right in our vision. In our church, we use a phrase that's actually more intimate than what even community is. We say that we want to be a family that's loving deeply. That's a pretty bold statement. That's something hard to grasp and hard to live up to. We're not just trying to recreate a community that's filled with social clubs, that's filled with like sports when you go to play, or you're just filled with committees. That's not why we're here. That's not what our purpose is. We're trying to create a family. And we take this language right from the Bible. They were Jesus' words when his family came seeking him. While Jesus was still talking to the crowd, his mother and brothers stood outside wanting to speak to him. Someone told him, "Your mother and brothers are standing outside wanting to speak to you." He replied to him, "Who is my mother and who are my brothers?" Pointing to his disciples, he said, "Here are my mother and my brothers. For whoever does the will of my Father in heaven is my brother and sister and mother." Man, when he said that, there would have been a hush in the room. Like, it's not like Jesus' mom and brothers were bad people. Obviously, Mary, she was awesome. And yet, here he says, they're waiting to speak to him, and he doesn't give them precedence? That's a pretty big insult. Even today, that would be a pretty big slap in the face, right? Parents out there, if your children all of a sudden said, "Nah, here's my mother and brothers here." Like, that would be hard to take for anyone. Now take a look at this quote from the Sirach. The Sirach's a book of wisdom found in the Apocrypha Bible. So the Apocrypha Bible, if you were to flip through your Bible, if you were to open it up, you'd come to the very end of the Old Testament, and that book's Malachi. You flip the page, and you come into Matthew. Well, that little flip of the page is 600 years of history. So there was a lot that went on, and the Jews actually wrote some different things. But the things they wrote, they valued them, but they didn't really treat them the same as their Pentateuch, our Old Testament. So in that book, or in the Sirach, they write about family. And here's a quote from it right here. "My soul takes pleasure in three things, and they are beautiful in the sight of the Lord and men: agreement between siblings, friendship between neighbors, and a wife and husband who live in harmony." In the original text, in the original language, as you construct that sentence, the priority does not go from last to first, but first to last. So the first priority is agreement between siblings. Interesting, isn't it? More important than even marriage. That's the case because in Mediterranean societies, and you kind of already know this, but I'm just going to reinforce it anyways, you didn't really pick who you were married to. They were arranged. And they weren't arranged necessarily for your benefit, right? Obviously. They were arranged so that whoever you were related to, the husband and the wife, it would benefit those families in some way. It wasn't as much of a concern if your relational satisfaction was met. And I think in a lot of cases, marriages didn't satisfy the needs, but there are certainly lots of examples of when it did happen. Now, I know the idea seems kind of strange, but it still happens today. And I had a friend when I was going to Tyndale. He was from India. And when I met him, he had a girlfriend from Ontario. I don't know how they had met or whatever, but they had been dating for about a year when his father told him to end the relationship. His father said that we have an arranged marriage for you, and we would like you to end this relationship now. When my friend told me this, I was shocked. I was like, "So what are you going to do? Like, it's pretty serious. Like, how could you just accept what your dad's going to tell you to do?" And what shocked me is that he said, it's more important for him to honor his father and mother, to honor his community, and even the other family of the girl he was meant to be wed than for him to just pursue this relationship that he had in Ontario. And so this past year, the two of them were married. They hadn't really met all that much. And they will learn to be happy because they really have no other choice. Based on their belief, they're both Christians, and so obviously we don't really condone divorce. But secondly, the shame it would bring upon their families and their communities, it would be unbearable, and they wouldn't do that to their extended families. It's interesting. Historically, there's some numerous examples as well of siblings taking precedent over marriage. And it even happened at the highest level of government in the Roman Empire, about 100 years before Jesus came on the scene. It happened between the Roman emperors, Octavian and Mark Antony. You might know of Mark Antony or remember that name because of Cleopatra, that whole Shakespeare romance or whatever that was written a while ago. And so the two of them were emperors. Octavian had the West. Mark Antony had the East. And, you know, there had been civil wars in Rome, and they wanted to stop it. And so Octavian's sister, Octavia, was offered as a bride to bring peace between the two emperors. And so what's interesting is that a Roman historian gives this account of Octavia. As the marriage had went on, things had started to deteriorate a little bit. And Octavia appealed to her brother with tears and passionate entreaties not to make her the most wretched of women after having been the happiest. She was the happiest because her one sibling was the emperor of the West. Her husband was the emperor of the East. That's a pretty high position. As it was, she told him, the eyes of the whole world were upon her, since she was the wife of one of its masters and the sister of the other. If the worst should happen, she said, and war breaks out between you, no one can say which of you is fated to conquer the other. But what is quite certain is that my fate will be miserable. What would you choose? That would be a pretty hard thing to do. Octavia ends up choosing her brother. She abandons Mark Antony, and he abandons her. And as history plays out, she chose right, because Octavian ended up being the great Caesar Augustus, as many of you will know from history. It's interesting, though, isn't it? You know, when you get married, your spouse becomes your number one priority. If you had to choose between the two, family and your spouse, I think for most of us who have been married and have the privilege, we'd probably choose our spouse when worse comes to worse. But that's not how it worked back then. In the New Testament period, you helped your brother and sister no matter what. You allied yourself with them, right or wrong. They were your kin. That's why when Jesus refuses to give his family precedence, from the reading in Matthew 12 that we had, it's a major insult. Like, that's a big deal. But it's also a major statement about what he expects of his disciples. He expects his disciples to treat each other like kin in that context of what family means. You don't need to go as very far into Acts 2, and I'm not going to put it up there, and I'm not going to read it, because I think for most of us, we've probably heard it quite a bit. If it's your first time hearing of Acts 2, I trust you will be interested, and I hope you'll be interested in just check it out and read it. But in it, it talks about how the disciples shared their life together. They shared their homes, they shared their money and their belongings, like siblings would back then. I mean, it was pretty radical. And it's all part of what Jesus' message was to his disciples. One of his clear commands to us was that we are to love one another. And it's a love that causes us to, or just the world begins to look at us and see what kind of love we have. It's from John, love each other. Just as I have loved you, you should love each other. Your love for one another will prove to the world that you are my disciples. I think this was honestly one of the most compelling things about the early church. Their love for one another overflowed to others. It's been noted by numerous Roman historians that the Christians, one of the few things that really drew people in towards them was that they took time to bury not only their dead, but the unclaimed dead. Think about it. It's not surprising that in a culture that values family so much, when somebody dies, family takes care of those expenses. What if you have no family? What if you're a slave and have no one to care for you? It was the Christians that took it upon themselves to find these unclaimed dead, whether it be in the rivers, the dumps. I know, like, terrible how they would just leave bodies like that. But they would take them and bury them and give them a proper burial. And it was something that the Roman culture noticed because it was so different. They would have said, only family does that. Why are you bothering with that? Why would you pay the extra money to give them a proper burial? But they did it because their love for each other just exploded, and they just cared for the people around them, especially the lowest of the low. So Jesus' command for us to love one another as a family continues to this day. It hasn't changed. The message continues to be simple. But when we talk about the church being a family loving deeply, we hear the word family and we automatically, it's just how we are as people, we automatically import our understanding of what family is, our experience of what family is, for good or bad. Because some of us may have only been an only child. What does it mean to have a brother and sister when you're an only child? How about parents that weren't around? Or problems at home, or with siblings that don't get along. Well, if you don't get along with your siblings, what does it mean to love someone as a brother? Whatever that definition is influenced by when you hear family, we need to separate ourselves from that when we understand family in a biblical context. It's hard because we are so subjective in everything we read. We import our own definitions in everything. And so our vision is challenging, right? How do we become a family that's loving deeply? Because it doesn't happen on its own. It doesn't happen by coming to church once a week, talking with a few people at greeting time and after the service. It doesn't happen. Because we need to get involved in each other's life, like you would when you're living in a community where you would get involved with your neighbor's lives, or at least that would be the ideal. And so at Country Hills, we express this family loving deeply most naturally in small groups. It's the median we've chosen to bring about this process of discipleship, learning to love one another. It's core to what Jesus' message was, and it's core to how we want to try to express it. Now, is small groups the only way to find it? No, of course not. But small groups can provide a rhythm for your life and for your schedules, where you set aside time throughout the week or the month or whatever it happens to be, where you learn to be discipled by loving others. But what holds people back from small groups? There's quite a few things. The obvious is time. I mean, we actually have quite a few people here that are involved in small groups, but not everyone is. It would be my hope that it would be on your radar. But the reality is, at any point in your life, there just might be too many time constraints. It would be my hope that you would be looking forward and trying to make free up time so you can go. But I also tried to think of other reasons why people don't join small groups and just some of the, you know, personalities you can run into small groups that people just sometimes want to avoid because they don't want to be around it. And I didn't really know how to communicate it funny, so I found a video that I think does it a little better than I could. So, Jim, if you could just cue the lights again.
What did you think of this week's sermon?
I actually had a problem with it. I really think he should have elaborated more on the different types of love that Jesus was referring to. One type of love was the phileo love, and one was agape love. And it's Greek, so don't worry about it. Maybe the pastor didn't know. He knows now. I emailed him about it. Pastors are so spread thin these days, and they really can't be at every life group, but there should be a theologian there to set people straight.
Great. Thanks for the insight. Anybody else have any thoughts? Kai? No? Okay.
I'm the quiet one in the group, obviously. Any question being asked of me me asking a question is completely out of the question. When I get in these large groups, I sweat. Thankfully, I have this shirt made of Under Armour. It's formal, yes, but it does the work.
So I was reading my Bible this week, and I came across a passage that moved me. It was in Ezekiel. Son of man, set your face against Gog of the land of Magog. Because sometimes in life we have to set our faces against the gogs that hinder us so we can love, you know. Because I want a family and kids. I have a niece, actually. She's so cute. Her name's Kimberly. And you got to look at my Facebook. There's a picture of me with her. She giggled for the first time this week. It was so cute. I'm the guy who only joins co-ed life groups where the ratio is in my favor.
Sorry I'm late. It's the traffic.
Marcy! Hey, I saved a seat for you. Actually, right over here. Scooch!
Look, the real reason why I don't show up to these things on time, so I can avoid those, let's get to know you games. Quite honestly, I really don't care what kind of music y'all are into. Because after all, we like every kind of music, except country.
Oh, hey, no problem. Come on in. We're just actually getting ready to start prayer requests. Is that Mariah Carey?
Whoa, hey, this guy's really going for it, am I wrong? Hey, be careful, she offers you an apple.
Okay, you can start, Michelle.
Okay, I actually have a few things this week. Let's see, to start off with, I really need you guys to pray for my job. I'm having some hard times with my coworkers and my boss, and so I just don't really know what to do with that. Also, discipline to get up and work out because I've not been doing that very well this week. And I'm really trying hard not to gossip. Just, I need your help and prayer with that. My cat started making like this weird noise and I don't really know what's going on there. So if you could pray for her, her name's Roxy. My car broke down and I got a speeding ticket. And then also I need you to pray for me and Chad. Okay, I don't even know if I can get into that, but you need to pray because he's acting like a fool and I just don't even know what to do. Oh, Team Edward and Team Jacob. Okay, just pray for that. And I think that might be it for this week.
How's your love life, Kevin?
I mean, the Lord's powerful, if I'm wrong. Am I wrong? I mean, if they can gather up all the animals in the universe, put them on a dinghy, and sail them across the world, he's got to find a woman for me.
Praise God.
Am I wrong? I'm probably wrong. I just want somebody to ask me how I'm doing. They won't. I gotta hide my emotions behind the jokes all the time.
You guys, thanks for coming out tonight. Have a great week, and we'll see you next week.
Yeah, maybe you don't join a group or want to be a part of the group because you either identify very closely with one of those people or you just want to avoid those people altogether. I don't know, perhaps. Andy Stanley, he's a very renowned pastor and preacher from North Point Community Church in Atlanta. I'm just on a big Andy Stanley kick right now. So I was listening to a sermon not too long ago, and he was challenging his congregation, and he came up with a phrase that I loved. He said, you need to become people who no longer just sit in rows, but who sit in circles. A couple of Sundays ago, we had House of Prayer here. I don't know, I bet you a lot of people were here. And they staged what would be a typical home church for them. And it was kind of awkward for some of us, right? We had to get in circles. We weren't going to sit in rows for the service. We were going to sit in circles and have to look at each other in the eye. I mean, we'd sometimes rather just stare at the back of people's heads than have to look someone in the eyes and share something about ourselves. But when we learn to sit in circles, we learn to share our lives together. We cannot all love each other and treat each other like brothers and sisters. There's so many of us. But if we can learn to do that with a few people, 10, 15, on just a deeper level, then perhaps we're starting to understand what it means to be a disciple of Christ and to love one another. So kind of to close, I wanted to just give you a few more concrete ideas of what it means to be loving deeply, what it means to be family. And there's these three things that I kind of thought of that might be kind of markers you can use. And there's so many more that you could use, but these are just three. First is when you find someone who prays for you every day because they value who you are and want to see you blessed. For me, when someone in my small group had told me they were praying for me every day, I was blown away. I was very humbled. But that's a family loving deeply. Because why else would you pray for someone every day? Because you love them and you want to see them blessed. How about this second one? Your small groups, they stop being something that you try to fit into your schedule because you have busy schedules. Instead, you start to schedule around your small group. That's when you know your family, your small group family, is starting to become important to you. Because it no longer takes the back seat, it's the front burner, and everything else takes second fiddle to that. And finally, this one I read of a while ago, and I thought, wow, that is family loving deeply. And it's when together as a small group, you come together, you pull out your calendars, and you're not just there to plan the next small group meeting or the next few meetings together. You're there to plan each other's lives with each, or like share each other's lives with one another. So important events. You have kids who have a recital coming up. Everyone puts that on their calendar. And some of the people try to make it. Because that's what family does. That's what grandparents do. That's what siblings would do. Those are a few markers that I think you can kind of look at in your own life and be like, can I get that kind of family loving deeply? So I'm here to say, or in conclusion, I wanted to say today, find a circle to join. It doesn't have to be in a small group. But small groups is an easy way for you to find something. If you're in a small group, if you're in a circle today, maybe you just need to open it up and invite a few more people in. Maybe you're in a small group and you've been together a long time, but you guys still don't quite feel like you know each other as well as you should. Maybe you need to structure it so you have a group that's entirely about prayer for one another and sharing those deep challenges and struggles you have. So I just want to pray for you today and just pray that you would find a circle to be a part of and that you can start loving one another so that the world will start to notice. Let's pray. Jesus, thank you for today. I thank you for everyone here. I thank you for the example you set, that we are to love one another. And you did that, Lord. You loved the disciples and you love us. You called us co-heirs with yourself, brothers and sisters. So Jesus, I ask that you would help us to find those circles. And that you would help our own circles to become deeper and more meaningful. And that we would just be a family. I just pray this in your name, Lord.